This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
At the White House today, Israel normalizes relations with two Arab countries. Palestinians feel betrayed by those Arab neighbors.
What they're really, in effect, doing is saying that Israel's behavior is acceptable when international law says that it's not acceptable.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, COVID has meant America's reputation precedes it in a bad way.
No more than 20% in any of the 13 countries that we surveyed said that the United States was doing a good job of dealing with the coronavirus outbreak.
And winter doesn't have to mean the end to your socially distanced outdoor hangouts.
We say there are no bad weather, only bad clothes. So we dress up and go out.
Norway with some cold weather advice and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Good to have you with us this Tuesday. President Trump welcomed officials from Bahrain, Israel, and the United Arab Emirates this afternoon for a signing ceremony at the White House.
We're here this afternoon to change the course of history. After decades of division and conflict, we mark the dawn of a new Middle East. Thanks to the great courage of the leaders of these three countries, we take a major stride toward a future in which people of all faiths and backgrounds live together in peace and prosperity.
The Abraham Accords are what these agreements are being called. They mark a change for two Arab Gulf states. Bahrain and the UAE are normalizing relations with Israel. In the past, Arab leaders insisted that the Palestinians and a Palestinian state would have to be part of any deal with the Israelis. But that is not what's happening now, as the world's Shirin Jafari reports.
A few days ago, hotel owners in the UAE capital, Abu Dhabi, got a letter from the Department of Culture and Tourism. It asked the hotel owners to start including kosher meals on their menus and to designate a separate area in the kitchen for preparation of kosher food. This would have been unthinkable not long ago, but it's one example of what normalization between Arab Gulf states and Israel looks like on the ground. The UAE-Israel deal will include other things like direct flights, tourism, economic investments, and more. Until recently, Israelis' ties with some Gulf states were the region's worst-kept secret, says Khalid Ilgindi. He's with the Middle East Institute in Washington.
In the past, those relationships were kind of under the table. Now they're announcing to the world that they're openly having these relations.
The Arab states didn't publicize their dealings with Israel in part because of the Arab Peace Initiative drawn up by the Saudis in 2002. In that accord, Arab nations endorsed the idea of normalizing ties with Israel if the Israelis ended their occupation and gave the Palestinians a state of their own.
So that's why many Palestinians are upset, because they view this as violating the Arab consensus. And for Palestinians, it's kind of giving away an important piece of leverage that they have.
Since the announcement of the deal with the UAE, Israel appears to be backing away from annexing the West Bank, at least for now. But for many Palestinians, that's hardly a victory.
It's a stab in the back, to be quite honest.
Diana Boutu is a lawyer based in the West Bank.
The idea that we see countries like the UAE and Bahrain normalizing with Israel, what they're really in effect doing is saying that Israel's behavior is acceptable when it's actually not acceptable. International law says that it's not acceptable.
Boutu is a former spokeswoman with the Palestinian Liberation Organization. She says in the past, when the two other Arab countries, Jordan and Egypt, signed peace agreements with Israel, they got back land that Israel had seized.
But in this case, this hasn't happened at all.
So what are these two Gulf states getting in return?
The UAE is the proverbial fox that has many, many different ideas, many different agenda items.
Hussein Ibish is with the Arab Gulf States Institute, a think tank in Washington. He says the UAE is keen to counter Iran and Turkey, its two regional rivals. And Ibish says the Emiratis are looking to purchase high-tech weaponry from the U.S.
That is the F-35 fifth-generation fighter, the Growler electronic warfare plane, Reaper drones with precision guidance, and other things. And they've been assured they're going to get that.
For Bahrain, though, the wish list is shorter, he says.
For Bahrain, it comes down basically to one issue, which is Iran and strengthening the coalition against Iranian hegemony.
Ibish says in the past few years, the Gulf states have seen the U.S. take a step back from the region. President Trump has consistently said he wants the U.S. military out of the Middle East.
UAE, Bahrain, and Israel are all looking to forge closer regional relationships, even with countries that a few years ago they would have thought it's impossible, precisely in the context of a waning U.S. presence.
Don't expect anything like a NATO alliance, he says, but do expect an increase in the country's intelligence sharing and surveillance technology. That worries Maryam Al-Khawaja. She's a human rights activist from Bahrain who was forced into exile in Denmark because of her activism.
I mean, we've already seen in the past how the Gulf states and other countries in the Middle East and North Africa have benefited from buying surveillance technology and other forms of technology from the Israeli government that they've used to oppress their own local populations.
A Canadian research group, for example, found that the Saudis used Israeli mobile phone spyware to target dissidents, activists, and journalists abroad. Khawaja says some Bahrainis have expressed anger about the kingdom's deal with Israel, even though dissent is likely to get them into trouble.
We're looking at oppressive, absolute monarchies who control everything. And therefore, what the monarchies do represent only themselves and not the populations.
The Trump administration is hoping that today's normalization deals with Israel will open the door to other Arab states. The big question is Saudi Arabia. The kingdom did allow an Israeli plane to fly over its airspace recently. The Gulf state of Oman has applauded Bahrain's decision to sign an agreement with the Israelis, a sign that it could be next. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafari.
Now the view from Israel. Yaakov Amidror is the country's former national security advisor. Yaakov, what does Israel get out of these deals with the UAE and Bahrain?
First of all, Israel is getting the ability to cooperate with another two important Arab states that understand that Israel is a fact in the Middle East, a strong country with capabilities to cooperate with. And this cooperation is not like in the past under the table. It is on the table. And you know that in the Middle East, under the table was very crowded. Now part of the partners which work together under the table are going to work together formally with diplomatic relations and full capacity of economic relations.
So you sound fairly optimistic, but there are some things that I wanted to press you on. What are the national security implications for Israel with this deal?
Look, first of all, the more Arab countries will be with good relations with Israel, it will be easier for Israel and for those Arab countries to contain the threats in the Middle East. And in the Middle East, there are two kinds of threats now. One led by Iran, based on its Shiite dream to have a Shiite crescent from Tehran to the Mediterranean. And the other one is the Ottoman Empire dreams of the Turks with the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood. And those two non-Arab states are a great threat to the area, and cooperation between those Arab countries which will have these relations with Israel is making the ability to contain those two threats much better than before.
Well, on the issue of weapon sales, Prime Minister Netanyahu said his government would oppose any sale of American F-35 warplanes to the UAE despite forging relations with the Emirates. President Trump said just today in an interview to Fox News that he would have no problem selling the planes to the UAE. So how would that affect Israel's security?
First of all, I want to remind everyone that America is a sovereign state. And America will do what is the interest of the United States of America. We have an agreement with the Americans, and there is an American law. that the White House should report every year to the Congress that Israel is keeping its qualitative edge. And I'm sure that if the Americans decide to sell the F-35, together the Americans and the Israelis will negotiate compensation for Israel, which will keep the Israeli qualitative edge.
I mean, we're kind of talking in abstract terms here because the details of the deals are not public. The Emirati foreign minister did say today that the agreement mentions the two-state solution. What do you make of that?
I don't know what will be said, but remember that the American plan, which was adopted by the Israeli government, one of the elements was a Palestinian state. The problem is the Palestinians are not ready to negotiate because we want to be sure that our security will remain in our hands, that the Jordan Valley will remain under Israeli control, and so on and so forth.
But Palestinians are aggrieved by this agreement because they feel the UAE has undermined what they clearly see as a priority.
This is the tragedy of the Palestinian, the thought that they have the key for the future relations in the Middle East. And slowly, slowly, they understand that they lost it because they refused to negotiate with Israel through the years. So the Palestinians is a real tragedy. They are not missing any opportunity to miss an opportunity.
Did you imagine you'd see this treaty signed in your lifetime?
We worked very hard when I was in the government that will happen. I didn't know when it will come, but we worked very hard that it will be a reality. And I'm more than happy that it happened.
Former Israeli National Security Advisor Yaakov Amidror, thank you for your time today.
You are more than welcome, and I hope that will be only the beginning. Shana Tova.
Shana Tova.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you too. Picture the island of Manhattan. Now picture a slab of ice, the same size. Scientist Jenny Turton says that's about how much ice has broken off the northeast coast of Greenland in each of the past two summers.
In 2019 and 2020, these 2 years consecutively, we've lost 50 kilometers squared both years.
Turton is a research scientist with Frederick Alexander University in Erlangen, Germany. She's been studying the Arctic's largest remaining floating ice shelf called Nyokovsfjordsfjorden, or simply 79 North in English. This week, her research team confirmed a Manhattan-sized chunk of 79 North broke off this summer, just like the previous summer. Warm air and water temperatures are the culprit.
In May and June, we had temperatures well above the melting point, which normally happens a bit later in the year. So we had some very warm and continuously warm atmosphere in that region. And then also the ocean has been warming underneath the glacier as well. So it's kind of vulnerable to two changes because it's floating on the water.
Rising temperatures, of course, point to a changing climate. And Turton says faster reductions in greenhouse gas emissions are needed to prevent its worst impacts.
We're running out of time for this window where we can still make a difference to reduce our carbon emissions.
At the other end of the globe, there's more news of change this week. It comes from a just-published analysis of satellite images of Antarctica's massive Pine Island and Thwaites glaciers. The ice tethering these glaciers to the Antarctic continent is weakening and in some places breaking up. Glaciers actually stabilize the whole area, and this study is the latest to reveal that the Antarctic glaciers are even more vulnerable than scientists thought. For the science behind how and why Antarctica's ice shelves are in peril, head to theworld.org/Antarctica. You'll see our deep dive into Thwaites Glacier there, complete with graphics and photos explaining why these mammoth pieces of ice are so very vulnerable and what's at stake. Up soon on today's show, an ancient wine factory is discovered in Lebanon.
We were extremely excited. You know, we were not expecting at all.
A 2,600-year-old wine press is rare evidence of Phoenicians making wine in what is today Lebanon. That story and more of today's news later in the show. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Both candidates for president are ramping up their efforts to reach Latino voters in these last weeks before the election. Former Vice President Joe Biden is in Florida doing just that today, including a stop at a Hispanic Heritage Month event. And President Donald Trump was in Arizona last night, attending a roundtable with Latino business owners.
Hispanic Americans embody the American dream, and they are great business people, like this guy right here. They're great business people.
Latino voters could help change the election's outcome if they vote. I'm joined by Michel Mariska, senior editor at KJZZ. He's a reporter with our series Every 30 Seconds, which looks at the young Latino vote in the U.S. Hey, Michel.
Hi, Marco.
So the courtship of Latino voters, it's been a theme in recent presidential elections. How does courting Latino voters in this election compare to previous elections, in Arizona specifically?
In Arizona, this wasn't the case in 2012. We're seeing a lot of diversity. As this state pulled away from being a Republican-controlled, very red state, even just a few years ago. Now, Kamala Harris has virtually visited Latino small business owners there. She was here this last weekend. And then just yesterday, President Donald Trump flew in to host a Latinos for Trump roundtable here in Phoenix. Arizona has 1.2 million eligible Latino voters. It's fifth in the nation. Aggressive voter outreach created the largest turnout ever in 2018, and it flipped a Republican-controlled Senate blue. There hasn't been a Democrat in the U.S. Senate in Arizona in 40 years. Mm. And now there's a second U.S. Senate seat. It's one of the most hotly contested in the nation. So, yeah, candidates are trying really hard to capture the vote here, both Biden and Trump.
Yeah, I mean, Arizona has been in the news a lot lately. It's become a battleground state. Are candidates taking note that Latinos could be a decisive vote there? What are you seeing?
I've been speaking with Chuck Coughlin. He's a Republican strategist who says Trump is seeking established Latino immigrants and their descendants in Arizona who are already voting Republican. He's brought that up to events in Arizona and on the national stage already.
You know, I'm a businessman. I'm here legally. This is my American dream. It's going to be that. It'll be that argument.
And he says Democrats will target the administration's policies against immigrants.
This is not a high-minded policy debate. It's that guy locked up children in cages. You know, that guy is evil. He's awful.
Coughlin warns that Trump will need to win Arizona's biggest county, Maricopa County. But the GOP's once dominant control of Arizona has dwindled to half of what it was in 2012.
So Democrats, meantime, are trying to recreate that 2018 turnout by reaching young voters and women who tend to vote Democrat. How's that working out?
The prominent activist group Lucha just launched an effort to bring 1 million Arizona voters to the polls this year. I spoke with organizer Ricardo Zamudio about the criticism that Joe Biden hasn't been doing enough to attract Latinos and that he doesn't have the draw to young Latino voters.
We may not have the Bernie Sanders or the Elizabeth Warren, but I think we do have an opportunity that otherwise with Donald Trump we wouldn't have.
Zamudio said the old Republican guard, right-wing immigration hawks that dominated Arizona's politics 10 years ago, led to a push now to turn the state Democratic.
So, Michel, I know you've been in touch with a young Latino voter who's going to the polls for the first time this year. What's she thinking going into these elections in November?
Adela Diaz. She's a young public health major on an academic scholarship at the University of Arizona. I met her before the pandemic, and even then, her biggest social issue was a lack of universal health care. She's voting for Joe Biden, no question, but I'll let her put it in her own words.
I think it's because the Democratic Party is good enough, not because it's the one, you know, that inspires all of us to go out and vote. It's good enough.
Good enough. I mean, Adela is pretty unimpressed. She doesn't have a lot of choice, though, does she?
No, that's right. She feels the Democratic Party doesn't represent her. So here she is again.
I don't know if I could ever see myself putting a Democratic Party sticker on my car. Maybe a Feel the Burn sticker, just because that's more up my alley, I guess.
Adela was originally an Elizabeth Warren supporter, and then later she turned to supporting Bernie Sanders. Biden was never really her first choice.
KJZZ senior editor Michel Marisco in Phoenix, Arizona. Michel, thanks very much for taking us to Phoenix today.
Thank you, Marco.
Michel's reporting is part of the World's Election Project Every 30 Seconds. The series is produced in partnership with public radio stations across the country. We're following young Latino voters in Texas, Florida, North Carolina, Washington State, California, and Arizona throughout the 2020 presidential election. For more stories from Every 30 Seconds and to see how the election is shaping up for these new voters, head to theworld.org/every30seconds. Traveling farther afield now to Lebanon, a new discovery by archaeologists there is exciting historians and wine enthusiasts everywhere. The World's Jessica Yarmosky has that story.
These days, if you like to kick back and enjoy a glass of wine or two, you probably have the Phoenicians to thank for that. That's the ancient civilization with roots mostly in modern-day Lebanon. Phoenicians have long been known to love their wine, says Aline Sadar. She's an archaeologist with the American University of Beirut.
The Phoenician wine is mentioned in the ancient text. It is mentioned in the classical text. So the Phoenician wine was very famous.
Phoenicians aren't credited with inventing wine. That right goes to ancient civilizations in the country of Georgia. But they did spread wine culture throughout the Mediterranean and beyond. Those vineyards you see in France and Spain and Italy, yeah, they were likely introduced to those countries by the Phoenicians. But not much physical evidence of their winemaking has been found in Lebanon, where most of their kingdom was concentrated. Until now.
But we were extremely excited, you know, we were not expecting at all a wine press.
A wine press. A really old one. It dates back around 2,600 years. Sadar and her team discovered the press in an area of Lebanon called Tel al-Burak, close to the city of Sidon on the country's coast. It looks like a big pit in the ground. There's a shallow basin where grapes would be crushed by foot, and the wine would flow into a nearby vat, a big one. It could hold over 1,000 gallons of the good stuff. Sadar says the press is made of really impressive plaster. It's well built. This is an exciting discovery because it's the first big piece of winemaking equipment unearthed in Lebanon. It's evidence that not only did the Phoenicians enjoy their wine.
We know that the wine was very important in rituals and often used, you know, in all sorts of libations.
And they traded it, too.
We were also excited to know that the economy of the Phoenician kingdom of Sidon rested also largely on agriculture.
That's news that Sadar says hasn't been clearly confirmed until now. The discovery is also really significant for the country of Lebanon.
It is very important for Lebanon to have now some evidence about the daily life, the economy, the trade in their homeland. Now we know how the Phoenicians themselves in their homeland were living.
One might guess that at certain moments, at least, they were living well. For The World, I'm Jessica Yarmosky.
You're listening to The World. An appeals court decision leaves some 300,000 immigrants in limbo.
I have been raising a beautiful family of four U.S. citizen kids. I have been learning English, going to college. So for some of us, it's a life-changing decision.
Temporary protected status ends. Now what? That's just ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. For the past 3.5 years, the United States has not been very favorably viewed by other Western countries. That's according to survey results from the Pew Research Center. But a new study they just published shows that our reputation has taken an even deeper nosedive just over the past year. Jacob Poster is at Pew in Washington. Jacob, Pew does a lot of surveys, and this is not the first one about America's image. What made this survey unique?
Well, we've actually been doing surveys for 20 years now, and we've been tracking the international image of the U.S. during that time period. And in the current survey in 2020, we're finding some of the lowest ratings we've ever found among traditional allies of the United States in terms of U.S. favorability, including in Japan, the U.K., Canada. You know, no more than 4 in 10 have positive views of the United States. And these are some of the lowest levels of favorability we've ever measured for the United States.
The title of the survey says a lot, I think. U.S. image plummets internationally as most say country has handled coronavirus badly. So how did your survey ask respondents about the U.S. and the coronavirus? Like, what was one of the questions?
Well, we asked people on whether various countries, including their own, were doing a good job of dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. And on that question, when we asked about it for the United States, no more than 20% in any of the 13 countries that we surveyed said that the United States was doing a good job of dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. And that's different from what people told us about their own countries. In most of the countries we surveyed, people were actually fairly happy with how their own country had dealt with the outbreak.
There are places where the U.S. image is seen more positively than other places. What country had the most people who thought the U.S. was responding well to the coronavirus?
In terms of response to the coronavirus, no country was over 20%. But when it comes to U.S. favorability, there are countries where a majority still have a favorable view of the U.S., but that number has shrank dramatically in the last year. South Korea is one country where 59% have a favorable view of the U.S. But even there, that's down almost 20 points from 2019, when 77% had a favorable view of the U.S.
And the survey also asked people to rank their own government's response to the pandemic. Where did people give their government high marks?
Well, mostly in Western Europe is where you see the most positive views of the coronavirus response. So Denmark, Germany, Sweden all have relatively positive views of their response to the coronavirus outbreak. And also in South Korea and Australia, a little less so in France and Japan, but still majorities there say that their own country has done a good job of dealing with the coronavirus outbreak. And in the US and the UK, less than half, 47% and 46% respectively, said that their own country had handled the coronavirus outbreak well.
I'm curious, how do Americans respond to these surveys that ask how other countries view the US? I mean, are these surveys learning moments?
I mean, that would be an interesting question to ask, you know, what people think about our surveys in a public opinion survey. But generally, you know, this is a question that we've asked every year for the last 20 years. The first time we asked this question was actually post 9/11, and we saw fairly robust ratings for the U.S., but then the Iraq War came along. And views of the U.S. fell pretty rapidly at that point, and only recovered actually when Barack Obama was elected president in 2009. So we've seen a long road in terms of overall U.S. favorability. And, you know, people are generally interested in this question, and it tells us a lot about the image of the U.S. internationally and how that changes over time and how it's affected by who's the U.S. president.
Finally, there was a question in the survey about world leaders. Who is most respected and why?
So among the countries that we surveyed, which I will admit is generally European heavy, German Chancellor Angela Merkel gets the highest ratings in our survey. 76% have confidence in her ability to handle world affairs versus only 16% among the same people who have confidence in U.S. President Trump. Vladimir Putin of Russia gets negative ratings. President Xi of China also gets negative ratings. French President Macron gets fairly positive ratings, and people are split on UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. So quite a range of answers on this question, but generally Merkel is seen as the most positive and Trump is seen as the most negative.
Jacob Poster, Associate Director of Global Attitudes Research at the Pew Research Center, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
This week, life for hundreds of thousands of immigrants in America got a lot harder and a lot more uncertain. That's because yesterday, a U.S. appeals court terminated temporary protected status, or TPS, for some 300,000 immigrants, people from four countries, Haiti, Sudan, Nicaragua, and El Salvador. Immigrants receive temporary protection from deportation when it's considered unsafe for them to return home. Jose Palma has been counting on TPS for protection. He's originally from El Salvador and heads the National TPS Alliance. Jose Palma, thanks for being with us. What did the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals actually rule?
So in 2017, the Trump administration decided to cancel TPS for all the countries involved in this lawsuit. And a judge in San Francisco actually agreed with us the procedure, the internal procedure, were not followed. So the Ninth Circuit decision is pretty much saying that the judge in San Francisco doesn't have the authority to stop it. That means pretty much allowing the Trump administration to continue canceling TPS for close to 400,000 people across the country.
What does the ruling mean for you?
This means that I can lose my immigration status next year. Therefore, I can be at risk of deportation after 22 years living in the United States and giving the best years of my life to the United States. I have been raising a beautiful family of four U.S. citizen kids. I have been learning English, going to college, volunteering as a soccer coach in my neighborhood. So for some of us, it's a life-changing decision.
And Jose, your kids, they were born in the U.S., and have you started discussing this with them and what you're going to do?
There have been many conversations at the dinner table. My son is going to college. I have a young daughter who is a sophomore in high school. It's hard to decide, like, if I have to leave. My son is 19 years old. He can stay by himself. But what's going to happen with the 5 years old who is just starting kindergarten and the 2 years old baby girl? They are all born in the United States. They all should be enjoying the life and happiness as everyone else. But you know what? On the other hand, I feel motivated because of the resilience that TPS recipients have shown. In 2017, we were told, you guys got to leave, go back to your country. But instead of hiding, we have been coming forward, sharing our stories. And the general American public actually would like for us to continue living in the United States. Yesterday, Ninth Circuit decision was a blow for many of us. It's scary to believe that we can lose our immigration status, but we also know that we are in a special moment in the United States in the next few weeks.
What could a new presidential administration mean for TPS holders like you? Has Joe Biden stated a position on the program yet?
Yes, there have been some statements, and the new president can absolutely, in the first day, stop the cancellation of TPS. That's what the new president can do.
Most Salvadoran TPS holders have been living in the U.S. Since two earthquakes hit Central America in 2001. How do you reply to those who say that was 20 years ago, nearly, your protection should expire? It is, after all, called temporary protective status. How do you reply to that?
It's 20 years living in the same place and giving the best years of your life temporary? We have been giving the best of our life. Can you at least give us the opportunity to continue living in the United States safe and away from worrying about deportation? And we are, and we have been giving the best we can to this country.
Jose Palma, originally from El Salvador, he heads the National TPS Alliance, telling us about the Ninth Appeals Court canceling temporary protective status for 300,000 immigrants in the U.S. Jose, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Immigrant doctors play a key role in the U.S. healthcare system, especially in rural and lower income communities. And for many of them, the pandemic poses risks that go way beyond just getting sick. The World's Ilana Gordon has our story.
Dr. Vivekanand Tiwari spent the last 6 years working at a hospital in Springfield, Illinois. Like many healthcare workers, when COVID-19 hit, he and his wife tried to reduce their exposure risks at home, because Tiwari was seeing patients with COVID.
Many times we slept separately.
The pandemic has been difficult for so many health workers. But for Tiwari and the scores of other doctors who are immigrants, they often have an additional stressor because of their temporary visa status. He's from India and applied for a green card 6 years ago. He's still waiting, and that wait could last decades. The U.S. caps the number of work-based visas for each country, and slots from India fill up fast.
The situation is that if something happens to me, my family will have to leave.
In other words, if Tiwari gets sick from COVID, and then if he needs long-term disability, or worse yet, if he dies, his family would fall out of status. This is terrifying for Tiwari and his wife, Shikha Shah. She just gave birth to their second child 2 weeks ago.
I have to go back to my country and start from scratch. That's the most scariest part of the whole situation.
In the United States, about 250,000 doctors are immigrants, representing about 1 in 4 doctors. That overall percentage is higher in rural and underserved areas. One of those areas is in southeastern Missouri, where nephrologist Raghavir Kura cares for kidney patients at all hours of the day and night, some of whom also have COVID-19.
Now, I'm right in front of a hospital where I have a patient who's COVID positive, and I'm going to go see that patient in the ICU. And the other day, I got called in the middle of the night. He would die in the next 1 hour if I didn't go, and I have to go.
3 years ago, Kura helped form a group, Physicians for American Healthcare Access. The group has been lobbying for legislation to ease and speed up the permanent residency process for doctors. It's hard to find a clear number, but his group estimates that about 12,000 immigrant doctors are currently in limbo. He says one fix is through legislation that would tap into employment-based visas that were never used up from other countries like Canada, and then transfer them to these doctors and nurses.
The unused visas from all these past years, let's use them towards the healthcare warriors, healthcare heroes.
Kura notes another problem with the visa system for doctors. It often ties international doctors to a specific employer, which means they can't relocate to regions that have the greatest need. For Kura, a lone kidney doctor in rural Missouri where COVID cases are on the rise, he worries. What happens to his patients if something happens to him?
We have a ton of immigrant, talented physicians from all over the countries working here who can deal with ICU patients. Why can't they work with me here? No, they cannot.
The pandemic has only added complications to U.S. immigration policies. That's according to Greg Siskind, an immigration lawyer who specializes in doctor visas.
Almost every aspect of the physician immigration system has been disrupted in one way or another.
He says visas have become even harder to access, and travel, of course, is more difficult. Congress is working to address these problems. One proposal that would ease the visa process for doctors and nurses and provide more protections for their families is included in the massive Health and Economic Recovery Omnibus Emergency Solutions Act, or HEROES Act. So far, nothing has passed. Siskind says the U.S. is looking less and less attractive as a place to practice medicine.
This is really the first time in my 3 decades of doing this that I've been hearing more than just the odd person here or there saying that they are looking at other countries and no longer interested in the United States because of the immigration issues.
As for Tiwari and his wife, they're not planning to uproot anytime soon. They're raising a family here. But when COVID-19 hit at age 38, Tiwari says one of the first ways he tried to ease his anxiety was to write a will. With so much out of his control, he's trying anything he can to protect his family. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
In the UK, there's a new pandemic restriction. It's called the Rule of Six. Starting this week, only 6 people can socialize together indoors. It's the first new restriction introduced nationwide by the British government since May. And UK authorities are encouraging people to snitch on their neighbors if they catch them breaking the rule. This all follows the grim news that infection rates are rising by about 3,000 cases a day in the UK. Our correspondent in London, Orla Barry, joins me now. It's been called the Rule of Six. How will it work exactly, Orla?
Yeah, well, Marco, it sounds pretty simple. Essentially, if you hang out with more than 5 people, well, you're breaking the law. But it's not actually that straightforward, because this rule applies both indoors and outdoors in England and Scotland. But if you're in Wales, 15 people can gather together outdoors. And in Northern Ireland, that number jumps to 30 people. There are also exemptions to the rules, so weddings and funerals can continue. In the gym, that rule doesn't apply. And places of worship, also large gatherings are still allowed in those places. How it will work? Well, it kind of all depends on how compliant people are. The government seems to think that people will comply. Here's the UK Policing Minister, Kit Malthouse.
The police will be encouraging and explaining the situation. We hope that at that stage most people will comply. And if they fail to comply, then obviously fixed penalty notices can be issued. But, you know, what we saw in the first phase of the lockdown is enormous compliance.
What about enforcement, though, Orla? I mean, are police expected to go around counting how many people have kind of gotten together?
Well, this is the issue. And listening to police talking about this over the last 24 hours, on the one hand, they say it's a little bit easier because the number of 6 people is obviously easier to count than 30 people. But equally, the police are kind of hoping that people will comply, similar to what Kit Malthouse said there, because the police are making the point, look, we have a lot of other work to do. This is Brian Booth. He's chair of the West Yorkshire Police Association. Have a listen to how he responded to it earlier.
Unfortunately, demand for us has increased significantly since the whole world's woken up out of COVID and the regulations have got slightly easier. So my colleagues will have to deal with all the usual policing incidents and try and deal with the COVID calls to service on top. And my colleagues will be normally going to assaults, crimes in progress, road traffic accidents, and be doing that before going to groups of over 6 people.
So limiting yourself socially to a group of 6, that's one plan. But then if somebody gets sick, what about testing? How much of an issue is testing capacity at the moment in Britain?
This has become a really critical issue, particularly over the last week. And there's been a huge demand, essentially, I think, since schools reopened. And yesterday, for example, in the 10 worst hit areas in England, there were no tests available at all. So what was happening was people were going onto the internet and trying to get details about where they could get a test and when they go get it, and they were simply told this site is busy so they could get no further. Or else people were being told there is a test available, it's available hundreds of miles from your home. So there's real anger about that at the moment, because the NHS, the National Health Service, has come out today to say a lot of their staff have had to stay at home because they can't get a test, they don't know whether they have the virus or not, and they're simply self-isolating for 14 days, and this is starting to happen repeatedly, so they're really concerned about it.
Orla, what's the likelihood of another national lockdown in the UK?
Don't mention the word. At the moment, it's still being viewed as pretty much the last resort. The Justice Secretary was asked about that this week, and he said, you know, this is the nuclear option. It's not something that we want to do. What they have been doing in the UK up to now is closing down certain parts of the country where the virus spikes. I mean, the last thing that Britain wants to do, or the government wants to do, is to impose another nationwide lockdown, because the last time they did it, the British economy took such a hard hit, I mean, a harder hit than most European countries, and they really don't want to have to go through that all over again.
The World's correspondent Orla Barry in London. Thanks very much, Orla.
Thanks, Marco.
A quote on Instagram today: I could breathe the whole day on my own. Russian politician Alexei Navalny posted that from the hospital in Germany, where he's out of a coma and off a respirator. Apparently, he still has a sense of humor. Breathing, he said, is a surprising process that is underappreciated by many. I highly recommend. The opposition leader was poisoned with a Soviet nerve agent last month and is finally recovering. Now he says he plans to return to Russia. We're joined by Russian investigative reporter Andrei Soldatov. Andrei, is there any doubt in your mind as to whether this poisoning was ordered from high up in the Kremlin?
Well, I'm not a biochemical expert, but it seems to be very unlikely that somebody in Russia would take such a big risk as taking out a very popular opposition politician without first securing some approval from the very top.
Andrei, you told the Washington Post that in Soviet times, the KGB refined their poisoning strategy to perfection, and that, quote, poison is unique in that its victim does not suffer alone. Their relatives and friends share the horrific experience of the loved one suffering. That was your quote. In today's terms, is this still a strategy? Like, what does the Kremlin have to gain from that?
It became even more effective because these days we have social media. So back then in the Soviet time, you would have a dissident family affected and his close relatives affected by the impact of this horrible experience of seeing someone close to you suffering from a poison. But these days we all have these pictures all over the internet, and lots of people who just follow the news about Navalny or think they might have some critical ideas about the Kremlin, many of them now feel very uneasy.
Well, we've seen a series of denials of any involvement in this case from various Russian officials over the last few weeks. Denials from Press Secretary Dmitry Peskov, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, now the head of Russian Foreign Intelligence, Sergei Naryshkin, implied that Germany was somehow involved in the poisoning. What do you make of all of these denials?
I think there is no strategy in place how to respond to this growing international pressure. To me, the most interesting thing is why the head of the Foreign Intelligence Agency decided to speak up and to comment on this issue. It's very, very unusual for our country to have a head of intelligence agency to talk about anything that sensitive. It looks like everybody just rushing to the media, trying to find a way how to get away from this very, I would say, difficult situation for the Kremlin.
I mean, is it possible that these boilerplate denials, it's just standard operating procedure, and maybe the Kremlin wants the public in Russia to think the Kremlin did it?
What's the trick, actually? If you look at the series of poisonings that we had in our history, most of these poisonings were actually carried out against Russian people. When you have a poisoning like that, you can always see that there are two messages. So you have some message to the international audience. But first of all, it's a message for the Russian people. We all understand that. So that despite all these denials, the message is very clear. That one needs to be really, really careful at what we are doing now in terms of making a stand against the Kremlin. Now it's much more riskier than it was like 5, 4, or even 2 years ago.
Alexei Navalny has said he's got plans to return to Russia, even though it's apparent that he was poisoned, at least with the knowledge of Russian authorities. Does it surprise you that he wants to go back?
I think it's a very brave of him to say that, and I applaud him for that, because we need politicians like Navalny in our country, and I think it's truly brave that he decided to get back.
Andrei Soldatov, an investigative reporter based in Moscow, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
those of us who desire a little company during lockdown have been sitting outside with a few friends this summer, keeping our distance. But what happens when the weather starts turning colder? If there is doom-filled music to go with many months indoors, cue it up here. Actually, no. Let's turn instead to Norway for some tips and some hope. They have a word there for doing things outside, even when it's cold. Friluftsliv. Lasse Heimdall is the Secretary General of Norsk Friluftsliv, a coalition of outdoor groups in Norway, and joins us from Oslo. Lasse, this concept of friluftsliv, what does that mean, and how do you define it?
For Norwegians, friluftsliv is the meaning of being outside, and it's also connected to the legal rights all Norwegians have to walk in the nature, to harvest from the nature, and to stay over, like camping in the nature. And this is a long tradition in Norway for all Norwegians, but also for guests coming to Norway.
And you're talking more than just outdoor sports like skiing or skating. It's more than that, right?
Yes, it's much, much more than that. It's all kinds of activities do in the nature, but also staying in the nature, like resting in the nature. So it's not only connected to physical activity, but nature experiences in a wide range of understandings.
So like sitting in a big parka with friends around a fire and drinking tea, would that be friluftsliv?
Yes, for example, yes.
How do most Norwegians that you know incorporate friluftsliv into their lives? How do you?
You know, we have cold winters, as you have in Boston. We have long, dark seasons, and we cannot stay inside all the time. We say there are no bad weather, only bad clothes. So we dress up and go out because it's a kind of a necessity.
Lasse, why do you think, though, that being in nature makes cold weather more tolerable?
You know, meeting the first cold degrees is a shock for most people the first time. But during after a few weeks, most people, the bodies adapt to the cold. And, you know, we are focused on good clothes, good shoes is the most important, using gloves, using hats, and, you know, dress up for the cold weather. And most people, they adapt to the changes of seasons and you know, wintertime in Norway is also a fantastic time for activities. You know, we go skiing, we go walking, some people go with snowshoes. We try to focus on the positive sides, especially now during this corona season.
What advice do you have for Americans to adopt friluftsliv into their lives, especially during the pandemic?
When we advise people here in Norway, we try to explain people how they can do it in the simple way. You don't have to buy a lot of equipment or expensive things to do it. Use the nature close to where you live and bring on some friends or family and share the nature experience with somebody else. It's social, it's healthy, and it's good for your body and it's good for your mind.
Lasse Heimdall, the Secretary General of Norsk Friluftsliv, a coalition of outdoor groups in Norway. Thanks for your advice. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's it from us today here in Boston, where the first crisp hint of autumn was in the air today. Hey, like Lasse said, there is no bad weather, only bad clothes. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH. You can find us online at theworld.org 24/7. Stay strong, stay safe, be healthy. We'll see you again tomorrow.